Thanks to the Booker Prize Foundation, RNIB is able to make the winning book and the other books on the shortlist for their prestigious prize into formats that blind and partially sighted people can read. Available now in giant print, in braille, and in audio is Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeleine Tien.
The orchestra leader had gone to the villages to recruit youngsters, and his friend, Li Delun, had taught them how to play.
"These kids have never even seen an instrument in their dreams,"
Delun had said. Even the way the new recruits held their oboes and trumpets was humorous, walking with them as if with a brand new girlfriend.
Aha,
Balut said, trying to clear his thoughts.
That was a clip of Angela Lin reading Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeleine Tien. And Madeleine joins me now. Now, Madeleine, tell us about the book.
The book is an almost 500-page epic of modern China, 20th century China, balanced between two important historical moments, the 1966 Cultural Revolution, which lasted 10 years, and the 1989 Tiananmen demonstrations. But I think the heart of the book is about three musicians who are studying Western classical music at the Shanghai Conservatory in the 1960s, and music is their form of expression, artistic expression, personal expression, and they end up having to compromise their selves and their artistic aspirations as the tenor of the times changes and as the political climate changes. In some ways, it's so inextricable that for me it's hard to imagine it without the ebb and flow of history. So in some ways, the novel, if I were to describe it in a different way, it's really about the life, the birth, the life and the death of one person, a composer whose name is Sparrow. So he's born just before Mao Zedong comes to power, he's born just before the communists win the Civil War. And we follow him until the end of his life. So in some ways, because of the nature of the Chinese Revolution in those 50 or 60 years, they upended everyone's lives, or everyone's lives were redirected in very particular ways. So it's almost impossible to tell the story of this life without telling the story of a changing country.
Now, because you've mentioned the name Sparrow, there are big differences between the American and the UK covers. Does the small bird on the American version symbolise the character Sparrow?
Oh, yes, I think that's right. The Canadian cover, I think it's the Canadian cover actually, that the one that you have in mind. Right. It's like a bird with, it's perched on a branch. It's a black bird. And the title's written inside its body. Yes, I think it's a reference to Sparrow. It's a reference to music. It's a reference to the precariousness of his life at certain moments.
And how does the UK, well, describe the UK cover for us, and how does that represent the book?
It's a gorgeous cover. It's a couple, a man with his arms around a woman. It's probably dating from the 1930s, 1940s, but it's constructed almost like a collage, in the sense that the man's body has been cut out, and beneath it you see the image of people in the streets. So it's a Cultural Revolution image. It's probably thousands of people and banners celebrating the worker, the people, the revolution. So we see the woman, and we only see the silhouette of the man with the history inside him. And it speaks to the historical trajectory of the novel and the individual trajectories and how they come into collision.
And where does the actual title, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, come from?
It's a line of music. So Do Not Say We Have Nothing is the Chinese translation of the French socialist anthem, the Internationale. So that anthem was translated into Russian and then translated into Chinese, and took on slightly different nuances each time, and slight changes to the wording. So in the Chinese, I think in the French version, the line is, "We are nothing, we have nothing, or we are nothing. Nous soyons, we are nothing. Let us be all." And in Chinese, it became the last few lines are, "Arise, slaves, arise! Do not say that we have nothing. We shall be the masters of the world." And it's a piece of music that every Chinese citizen who lived in this time period would know the words, and it became the anthem of the Chinese Communist Party, but it also was the piece of music that the students chose to sing on the night of June 3rd, 1989, as they were leaving Tiananmen Square, as the massacre was unfolding around them. So it's a piece of music that has been become the container for the aspirations of multiple generations of Chinese citizens.
Now, music's very important to the book, but in the writing, did you listen to music as you were writing it?
All the time. It was one of the greatest pleasures of writing this book, and one of the pieces of music that's very important to the novel is Bach's Goldberg Variations, and in particular the two recordings by Glenn Gould in 1955 and 1981 that bookend Glenn Gould's recording career and, I guess, his life. And I would just listen to it on repeat. There was something, because the Goldberg is basically a simple aria. It begins with a simple aria, simple motif in the bass line, and then a series of 30 variations and canons that rework this simple theme in increasingly complex ways and touching a full spectrum of human emotion, an emotion that we don't even really have the words to articulate. It's an astonishing piece of music. The 1955 recording is probably about 30 minutes, and I just put it on repeat, and I would listen to it for hours at a time, every time I sat down to work on the book, day after day after day, and it just became part of my thinking process and part of the structure of the book and part of what the book hopes to touch on in terms of the range and the spectrum of emotion.
"Wasn't it a memorable time?" the man said. "Learning to play the oboe in the middle of the Japanese invasion, reforming our thoughts, and holding ballroom dances every Saturday night. The great leaders like to waltz."
Now, the main character is referred to by a number of names, and I've had the experience of this myself. How common is it for people from Asia to have a Western name?
Very common. In this case, it's actually Li Ling. Zhang Li Ling becomes Marie, and then she is also called Girl by her father. So she has these multiple names. But I think for every Chinese person in the diaspora, they will definitely have two names, their Chinese name and their English name, and a whole range of nicknames in between. And nicknames are extremely common and popular in Asia and elsewhere. There is no sense of conflict with multiple names. It's sort of taken for granted that there are, you know, levels of intimacy in relationships and therefore with names. And they all speak to the individual and they're resonant of the different relationships in their lives. So one of the things the child realizes after her father dies is that he was the only one who called her Girl. That was his nickname. It was a sort of playful nickname. And after he leaves, nobody speaks to her by that name. It's lost. It's an emblem of the relationship itself.
"You must know how things are. You are justly celebrated. A champion of the land reform campaign. A triumphant musical foot soldier. We hardened ourselves at headquarters, didn't we? We were the first to be reformed through struggle. As Chairman Mao says, true rebellion is not organized or beautiful. Heroes like you built the road. I'm only following the path."
Now, the audio version is narrated by Angela Lin. Do you think you've given her a hard time?
Very hard. It's a very difficult book to narrate because there's also Chinese calligraphy and writing in the text. So that, of course, was something we had to think about how to narrate, when we could reference it and when it would simply we would hope that something in the text would call to mind that image of the Chinese calligraphy or the Chinese ideogram. And of course, there's different, so many different registers in the book. So because it's a time of great political change and in moments it is a totalitarian state, there is all the official language, the ideological language, the political slogans, the parroting of words, that everyone had to learn that that register in the public sphere. And then there's the private sphere, personal language, family language, intimate language, and then there's music and so on, and there's mathematics and mathematical notation, and there's visual images. it's sort of a jumbled book of records that is a sort of a response to an unofficial history of China.
And I'd like to see the Braille version as well.
I love this so much, and I think the book is open to this, all these different forms, the different languages inside the language, tactile ones included. Actually, at earlier versions of this book, there was a lot to do with sight, and I had actually done a lot of research, and I had gone with Travelize, which is a travel agency where you go with people and then you describe the sites that you're seeing or the roads that you're seeing, and so I did the guiding for a trip in Croatia, and I think all the research and the thinking and the incredible conversations that I had will probably find its way into another work. It didn't end up in this one for different reasons, but one of our closest friends, my partner's closest friend, is a poet named John Esfour, and he lost his sight when he was just a child, when he was in Lebanon. And he's always been one of our first readers and our closest friends, and he passed away. And I still think of him in some ways as one of my dearest readers.
Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeleine Tien is available in Braille, available in giant print and in audio from RNIB. Madeleine Tien, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.